Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Friday, and welcome to Alive to Thrive with Brenda Fraser. Each week, Brenda brings you interesting guests and timely topics to uplift and motivate you to be all that you can be today and for all your tomorrows. Join Brenda and Alive to Thrive every Friday at noon Central Time, right here on Greater Good Ministries Radio. And now, here's Brenda Fraser.
Hello and welcome to Alive to Thrive. My name is Brenda Fraser. You just heard a very small section of some awesome piano music by Kevin McKendry. That was called Boogie 427, and we'll play more of that later in the program. Very excited Kevin could be with us today from Nashville. I actually saw him perform last summer at the Bluebird Cafe down in Nashville, and he was playing with the Mike Henderson band, and I was sitting directly behind the piano, and I was mesmerized. I'd never seen anyone put a piano like Kevin. Not surprisingly, he has toured with many, many musicians, such as Leroy Parnell, Delbert McClinton, the Allman Brothers back in the day, and has recorded with Brian Seltzer Band and Etta James, and he's just got a full range of styles, but his talent is unmatched by anyone I've ever seen, and I've lived in D.C. and saw musicians at the Kennedy Center and everything. So welcome to the program, Kevin. How are you today?
I'm great, Brenda. How are you?
Thanks for calling in, and we know that you're a busy guy, and you run a recording studio as well, and I don't know when you have time to sleep, but tell us how you got started in the industry. At what age did you start playing piano, and who introduced you to the piano?
Well, I started playing the piano long before I got into the industry. I started playing when I was around 3 years old. My grandfather was a musician, and he kind of got me started on it. But also my parents played. My father played the piano, and I had another grandfather who played the guitar and just was kind of surrounded by music, and I just always loved it.
Awesome. And now, did you grow up on the East Coast or in the Nashville area?
No, I grew up in Fairfax, Virginia, outside of D.C.
Okay, yeah, I saw that. I also had lived in that area as well when I was growing up in my early years, 3, 4, 5 years old. And so you were exposed to some music probably from the Blue Ridge Mountain areas, were you not?
I was. Mostly the music that was played in my house was, you know, was my dad's records, and there it was mostly R&B, '60s music. I listened to a lot of Junior Walker and B.B. King and Jimmy Smith, and those were the kind of records I grew up on.
So I guess it really shows the effect. I know there's that theory on the Mozart effect about exposing kids at a young age to music to help them learning, but you were exposed to music at a young age, and probably it was just so part of your family and your culture, it was second nature to sort of pick up an instrument. But, you know, at what point is it talent and genetic predisposition sort of, and what is discipline and learning the skill?
Well, I think it's something that's inside of people. That's a love of music. I mean, I see it in my son, who's very gifted. And I think it's just it's a genetic thing, and really the motivation behind the long hours of practice and all that really is just the love of music and the want to do it. I've never sat down and decided, hey, I'm going to practice. I sit down because I want to play the piano. I enjoy doing it, and I like figuring things out on it, and I've always been that way. So it's not that I have any kind of great self-discipline. I don't. It's just that I do what I like to do, which is sitting at the piano.
But the speed that you can play the piano, I mean, without your fingers falling off and having any kind of arthritis or anything, I can't even imagine the speed that you play at. I mean, obviously you must practice a lot, or just you're on it every day, or you've just been doing it all your life. But let's talk about your son Yates, because there are some great YouTube videos about him, and there was one that showed him, you started him on the piano at age 2 or 1 or before?
Yeah,
he's
been making music since he was born. He had before he could walk, he had a little toy keyboard that a friend gave him, and he would fall asleep playing that thing, and he'd be so tired he'd play it with his foot. And he just, like me, he just, it was just in him. He loved music, and he just liked it so much, and that's all he wanted to do. I mean, from, like I said, before he could even walk. So.
And he's how old is he now?
He's 11. He'll be 12 at the end of the month here.
Wow. Well, happy birthday, Yates. A shout out to him. And what do you see, in his future? Do you see recording CDs or touring and performing like you did? Or what do you see for him?
I think probably, it's whatever he would like to do. He talks about, I love this idea, that him and I, when he gets older, just having a father-son duo and traveling the country doing that. But,
cool.
More realistically, I think he'll probably, since there's a recording studio in his backyard and sessions going on out there, he'll probably end up start making a living in recording studios. And he's already got a band now that they play gigs around Nashville, and they even played one in Memphis here a while back.
So cool. What's the name of his band?
His band is called Cumberland Blue, and it's a youth band. He's the youngest one in it, but it's a group of kids ranging from his age, 11 to 18. They've gotten a lot of support.
Yeah, teens and that. So let's talk about when you first started performing. So you were playing the piano from a young age. When did you start going on the road as a musician?
I was probably 18 years old when I first went on the road. I started, which is when I started making a living do it. I was 17, 18 when I had my first recording session, playing on my first record, and pretty much have just been doing it ever since then. I did spend a little time in college while I was also playing regionally, and what ended up happening is just I had touring conflicts with final exams, and that's when I had to make a decision: do I want to go tour Europe or do I want to go take my finals? And I think we know what I chose. So.
Yeah, well, and that's a hard decision, and a lot of musicians face that, those conflicting priorities, and then later did it change after you became a father yourself?
Well, by the time I became a father, I'd kind of made it so that it would be very difficult to do anything else for a living other than what I do. Though I did build the recording studio, and with the hopes of not having to travel so much, and that's kind of starting to work out some now. I really don't travel. I travel a fraction of what I used to. Because most of my work I just do in the studio.
So what was life like on the road? Did you play one city and then get on the tour bus and go to another city? And
Pretty much, yeah. That's
balance in your life when you're doing that.
I'm sorry, I had trouble balancing my life. Yeah, well, it's being on the road is definitely you know, takes you out of your comfort zone, you know, and although you just kind of learn to do it.
What were some heartaches that happened, you know, canceled shows or, you know, did you ever have any, God forbid, disasters like what happened up in the Indianapolis State Fair last year with stages collapsing or anything like that?
I've never had anything that I can remember. I'm sure there's some crazy stuff that's happened that I just can't remember at the moment. But, yeah, most of the heartbreak of being on the road and a musician really doesn't have to do with being on the road so much. It has to do with being away from home and maintaining a marriage and a family can be difficult when you're away. When I travel, I usually don't travel for more than 2 or 3 days at a time, but there have been times where I've been gone for as long as 6 or 7 weeks, and, you know, that can take its toll.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you manage that? I mean, there's so many musicians that get caught up in drugs and alcohol and the pressures of the industry. How did you stay immune from those kinds of pressures?
Well, I don't know if I'm immune to those kinds of pressures, but you have to look at what's important in your life and make your decisions based on that. And, you know, what's important to me in my life is my family and, you know, most important is my family. So if what I'm doing doesn't line up with that, then I shouldn't be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I, you know, music is also very important in my life, and I've got the support of my wife and she's always supported me doing this. So even though it's difficult, having those things in your life, I imagine if I were, you know, if I didn't have a family, I probably would be more susceptible to, you know, all the pitfalls of touring. But, you know, hard for me to know because I don't know. I've been married for 22 years, so.
Wow, that is unusual. And, I mean, where do you get your, what's your due north? What's your compass point that helps keep you centered in addition to your family and knowing that you have a supportive wife and a talented son at home? I mean, there must have been some type of philosophy or guiding principles that, you know, you either learned from your parents or picked up along the way in terms of, you know, how to maintain a level head and stay cool and under, you know, there's a lot. It's a very changing dynamic. No 2 days are the same, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, true. Yeah, no 2 days are the same for sure. I just try and keep my eye on the prize, which is doing the things that I love and being with the people that I love. And, so when I can't be, I just kind of focus on, well, I got to get through this to get what I want. As far as a philosophy or a more of a mission statement, I base my studio on, is that my studio's mission statement anyway is, I'm making good music with my friends. And if I'm not making good music with my friends, I don't want to do it in my studio. We can, you know, I can go make music I don't love with somewhere else. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, you have a lot of friends, and I do want to encourage people to look at your website, kevinmckendry.com, because on Kevin's site, he lists a lot of the musicians that he's performed with and partnered with, Delbert McClinton and Leroy Parnell, and the list is long. There's about 20 artists there, and I love that you have them there because people can click on the link and go learn more about that particular artist and learn more about their musical style and what they're up to. So talk about some of your friends. How did you hook up with Delbert McClinton, for example?
Well, I hooked up with Delbert. I met Delbert. It was the first day I came to Nashville to play with Leroy Parnell, actually. And the way that happened, this is one of my favorite stories, actually, because it comes from one of my favorite people, and one of my heroes is Chuck Lavelle, who's a piano player and plays with the Rolling Stones, and he played with the Allman Brothers and all kinds of people, and he's a pretty amazing guy. Anyway, I had met him in my early 20s when I was playing with the Tom Principato band, and he produced a record for us, and Chuck and I kind of hit it off, and I kept in touch. He asked me to keep in touch, and so I did. And I was at a point, I was still living in Virginia, and I was at a point in my career where I was struggling. I was working a lot, but wasn't making enough money. And I took a job selling pianos at a piano store in Falls Church there. And I really didn't like it. And I it was just not me. I had to wake up early and wear a suit every day. And I did that job for about 2 months, and I came in and told my boss, you know what, I have to quit. I'm not going to leave you hanging, but I got to quit. And so I did, and I called home to tell Laura, my wife, that the answering machine, and there was a message from Leroy Parnell. I said, hey, this is Leroy Parnell. I got your number from Chuck Lavelle, and he said you're a piano-playing man. And it all happened right after I quit my job. I moved to Nashville about 8 months later, and that's where I met Delbert. And I was in Leroy's band for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And Delbert and he were, you know, they're in the same circle. So I, you know, kind of ran into them a lot. Played on Delbert's first cruise with Leroy. So it was, you know, he's part of that. You know, there's a whole kind of group of musicians that play a lot together, and that I became part of that group then.
Well, I just like that story so much because one of the things we talk a lot about on this show, Alive to Thrive, is that the principle of when you let go of something that's not working for you or is not your passion, even though that's scary to let go of something and there's a vacuum, then the universe can fill that vacuum with something better. And so that was a perfect example. You let go of a job that wasn't fulfilling to your soul, and then you immediately got the call from, you know, that was just perfect.
It was just amazing. Freaky, yeah.
That is something that happens, I think, a lot. But it's getting to that place of faith and trust in yourself that you're going to land on your feet no matter what, and it's better to be, broke and happy than doing something you don't love. And so many people do jobs, you know, they stay in that job with the suit and are miserable, or stay in that desk job, or, you know, whatever it is, and it just kills their soul. And they end up taking pharmaceuticals and antidepressants and getting divorced.
Right.
And, you know, it's just a whole chain reaction. It's not worth it. And so, so you've been living your passion for quite some time. And tell us about Delbert's Cruise, because I know another one's coming up here in January. And that information is on Delbert McClinton's website. I want to let people know that. And this sounds like a fantastic cruise. Oh, my God, there's so many different musicians
It's really, really great. And this will be the 20th one. I mean, it's hard for me to believe. 20th annual crew, and I've been on all of them, which just really makes me feel old. But but it's a blast. I mean, it's just nonstop music and fun, and you know, it's a reunion of sorts at this point. I see a lot of people who I only see on the cruise now, a lot of musicians and bands and friends. It's really just great, and I know it's great for the fans too, because there isn't so much of a partition between fans and artists and musicians, and and it's just kind of like being on vacation with your favorite artists for a week.
I have a friend that does that with a jazz cruise every year, but this one just sounds amazing. And Let's talk about some of the people that are going to be on that. So it's called the Sandy Beach Cruise, and it's the 20th anniversary. And on the on Delbert's website, which is just delbert.com, the musicians are listed there. And, you know, one I hadn't heard of for a while was Jill Spool. I was tickled to see her name. She's from Denver, and I used to live in Denver. But there's
I think she's new because I didn't know she must be
yeah,
new. I haven't heard her.
Yeah, she's kind of neat. And so talk about, is there concerts every night on the cruise? Or what? Give us a sort of a, what happens those 7 days?
Well, what happens is the music starts usually at noon. First show would be at noon, and it goes, they'll go all the way into the wee hours of the morning. I mean, there's and sometimes there's three or four bands playing at one time in different venues, and it's nonsense. And then after the last, you know, the last show is probably scheduled to end around 1 a.m. or so. But after that, there's a jam, and that will, you know, go as long as anyone's crazy enough to go. So,
oh my goodness, not much sleep on that cruise. But as everyone knows, cruises have fantastic food, and so this one, what is it? Sail out of Florida?
Yeah, I think yes. We've also gone out of San Diego in the past too, and even Houston. But I think we're going out of Miami this time. I'm not positive.
It's on the Norwegian Pearl, and they'll have Marsh Ball and Richard Thompson, Paul Thorne, Al Anderson, Chuck Cannon, so many, the McCary sisters. There's so many people listed on here. And they do have a payment plan, so for people that are listening that want to check that out, you can go to sandybeachescruise.com and check out that cruise with a bunch of talented musicians. So tell us, you know, some are there any funny stories you'd like to share with us that, you know, I love the story you shared earlier. But so you got to Nashville, and, you know, you were the new kid. What was that like breaking into an established group of musicians that, you know, had worked together, known each other for a long time?
Well, I was really lucky in the way that I came to Nashville. Most musicians come to Nashville without a gig, and they come there looking for work. And I got there with a good job, you know. I'm 24 years old, and I was Leroy Parnell's piano player. So that kind of instantly gave me, some credit. And so I, you know, in a lot of ways, I didn't have to kind of do the things that a lot of musicians have to do when they get to Nashville and go out and play these kind of not so great gigs and not make a lot of money, and you kind of network and all that. My networking and all that kind of already had been done for me. So, which doesn't mean that I didn't have to work at it, and doesn't mean that, you know, I'm certainly more well connected 20 years later in Nashville than I was then. But like I said, I was lucky. I was lucky in that way that I came in with a good gig.
Well, it's probably because you're such a nice guy and so laid back. And I mean, it's unusual to meet a performer that, you know, doesn't, you know, you don't exhibit much ego. And I know there are a lot of people in the industry with huge egos. I mean, how have you stayed, you know, sort of keeping your ego in check and stayed right size, as they say?
Well, you know, the ego is a funny thing, but because on one hand, you know, ego is a real funny thing for an artist, because the thing for me that I think keeps me getting better is my self-loathing. You know, I listen to myself play. I'll go out in my studio and I'll do overdubs for somebody, and I'll be, you know, I'm just working by myself, and I can, it's hard to make myself happy. And if I'm not feeling well or whatever, and maybe I'll come back the next day and listen to what I did that I hated the day before, and I go, "What was wrong? That sounds great." You know, So on one hand, you've got to love what you do, and you've got to know that you're good at it. And in order to get better, you got to hate what you do and hate how you do it. So it's a struggle.
Well, it's always trying to get right and do better. So you're constantly trying to move forward and improve
yes.
upon yourself. But I think sometimes artists, and whether they're musicians or painters or visual, are their hardest critic and harshest critic. And,
yes.
you know, it sounds great to most people, you know, you would find some minor flaw that no one would know. But that kind
true.
Of keeps you always trying to perfect your craft, would you say?
That's true. And you're right about people not hearing the little details. However, you have to, if you add up all those little details, then you can, you know, that's what's noticeable. You're right. You might not hear if I make one little clam in a song, but if I don't address that one little clam in that song, I'm going to have a million clams in that song and everyone will know. So
when you're writing a new piece of music, do you first just sit down and free flow and write the music and, play the music first and then put the notes to sheet music, or do you not ever use sheet music and just...
I don't use sheet music at all. I can't read music. I'm self-taught. So, which, in a way, has been a hindrance, and in a way, it is not. But no, when I write music, it usually is just something that's already floating around in my head, and I'll just sit down at a piano or a guitar or whatever instrument and you know, play what it is I'm hearing, and just kind of let it happen. You know, songwriting for me, and I've always kind of viewed it this way, similar to what Michelangelo said about sculpting. You know, he said, you know, that sculpture's already in that rock. It's just up to me to remove the rock. Well, I believe that these songs, all these songs, they're already here. They're in the ether somewhere. And it's up to me to pull it out. I'm not creating it. I'm just finding it.
Wow, I love that. That's beautiful. That is so metaphysical and so beautiful. All the wisdom is in the universe, the creative universe, and it's tapping in, tuning in the channel, pulling it down, downloading it, so to speak, or finding the sculpture within the rock. That was a great way of putting it. And with that, we're going to take
honestly, that's the way it feels when you do it. Because I always,
wow.
You know, if I'm playing, because, you know, my playing, as you saw at the Bluebird, is improvisational. You know, it's spontaneous and it happens. And I know when I'm doing my best, when I'm not doing it, when I'm able to just kind of be outside of myself and witness it. And so it's hard to take credit for it when you're watching someone do it. And, you know, it just happens that it's me. But it feels like when it's really on, it feels like it's coming through you and not from you.
Well, that aspect of coming through you, I think, takes the ability to get your ego out of the way and be the vessel and be the channel. And so you're the pipe, not the water, and you're allowing that creativity, as you say, that creativity to come through you, but it's keeping the blocks free from the flow so that it does flow, and,
right.
and that's, you know, that is true inspiration when it is,
yeah,
just,
exactly.
and you're in
you
the zone.
You gotta get out of the, you have to get out of the way for it to happen.
and I think some people tend to overthink it, and
mm-hmm.
or they start out with the sheet music. I mean, I felt that way as a child. I was trying to learn piano with the nuns, and the nuns were, you know, forcing me to kind of do all the sheet music. And, you know, I quit after a few years. And And I was very sad because I wanted to play more of the boogie woogie, you know the stuff that you do. That was like my dream, but I didn't feel encouraged to do that from by the teachers I had at that time. And I think a lot of people might go into a learning situation with a music instructor and, you know, hit that roadblock and then quit and say, you know, tell themselves that they don't have talent. But a good teacher will encourage exploration and help their students open up those channels, would you say?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, this is we homeschool my son, and this is one of the things we talk about with learning is, people are much more, people are going to learn much more about the things they're interested in than things they're not. And somehow, and with the homeschool thing, my son's not particularly fond of math, but one thing we do is we incorporate math in the things that he does like. You're a musician, you're on tour and you've got the promoters paying you this and you got, whatever, you can incorporate it into, anything into anything in your learning. And if you try and force someone to learn something they don't like, there's no real payoff. There's nothing for them other than they can maybe pass some test they don't care about, learning comes from love and passion. I mean, that's like I said, I've never been real self-disciplined with music or anything, but I've spent a lot of time doing it because it's what I enjoy doing. I love it. People are born with a love of learning, and I think it gets sucked out of them sometimes by people, by teachers who are not really aware of that,
Right, right. Well, I couldn't agree with you more. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to Alive to Thrive. My name is Brenda Fraser. Our guest today is Kevin McKendry, a piano player, owner of the Roadhouse Recording Studio in Nashville, and to be exact, Franklin, Tennessee. And we are having a discussion about music and about creating music and making music. So we'll be right back to continue our conversation. Stay with us.
We're open for business. The Greater Good Ministries Book and Gift Shop is now open for business, featuring metaphysical and uplifting books from your favorite authors, such as Doreen Virtue, Wayne Dyer, Michael Edward Owens. We've added handcrafted one-of-a-kind jewelry, pendants, earrings, and bracelets, and now have an exclusive selection of crystals, rocks, and stones for your metaphysical toolbox. Take a look at our hand-dug Arkansas crystals, imported Brazilian crystals, Tibetan crystals, and Reiki healing stones. All of our rocks, crystals, and stones have been Reiki infused, blessed, and cleared, ready for use. You can reserve your copy of Crystal Healing 2012 and Beyond, Reverend B's new book, A Comprehensive Guide of Rocks, Crystals, and Stones for the New Age. Visit ggmradio.com and click Bookshop in the menu bar. That's ggmradio.com.
Remember when your neighbor found us naked in the car, and the time some outdoor action got us kicked out of the park, getting frisky in the dark? I gave your eye a poke, think the dog is in the bed, do I smell smoke? You and me, we never, ever, ever give up.
You didn't give up on sex. Don't give up on birth control either. There are more methods than you think. Visit Bedsider.org to compare all the choices. Brought to you by Bedsider and the Ad Council. Bedsider.org.
You're listening to Alive to Thrive with Brenda Fraser on GGM Radio. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Alive to Thrive. My guest today is Kevin McKendry. He's a piano player from Franklin, Tennessee. And Franklin's a cute town. It has a lot of Civil War history and great little shops and wonderful, just a wonderful atmosphere. Kevin, talk to us a little bit about Franklin and about the Franklin Theater. I know that it was saved. It was a historic house, and I know you just recently performed there with Leroy Purnell at a sold-out show on the 13th. Tell us about that show and about the theater.
Well, the show was a blast, and it was a 20-year reunion of that original band that we had with Leroy that I was telling you about when I first got to Nashville. And we all play together in various different bands around Nashville from time to time, so we've all remained close in that band. But it was great to get back together and do it again. Yeah, the Franklin Theater is a really neat little theater. They've done a lot of really nice stuff with it. Great place to play. When we first moved to Franklin, we just loved it because of the charm, and we lived right in that downtown area, and we could walk to that theater. But it wasn't it was just a movie theater. It was kind of a cinema and draft house. You know, you'd go there, have a beer, and watch a movie. And we just loved it because we could walk there. But we since moved out to the country. You know, we're still in Franklin, but we've to build the studio and have a place for Yates to run around. So now they've changed the now it's a music thing. I think they still have movies there, but they've been really getting some great acts in there too. I know Booker T was there and Los Lobos was there and Dr. John, and it seems like I've played there four or five times with four or five different people. I played there with Delbert, and I played there with John Oates, played there with the McCrary sisters, and I played there with Kix Brooks, and then most recently with Leroy. So I love it because it's you know, I get in my truck and go right home 5 miles away.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, you've played in small group settings and like that, and then you've played on huge stages around the country, and I know you're going to be touring here to several places around the country with the Kix. Is it Kix Brooks?
Kix Brooks, yes.
Yeah. Talk about the tour coming up and what kind of places you'll be going and things like that.
Well, mostly this summer, it's outdoor venues and, music festivals and fairs and things like that this summer. And this is when Kix really does his most work. He doesn't tour a whole lot. He maybe does 20, 30 dates a year, which is perfect for me. I don't want to be gone too much. And it's mostly just those kinds of things for the summer. And then after the summer's over, he probably isn't going to be touring a whole lot at all. So,
well, I do want to tell people where they might be able to see you with Kix Brooks. Michigan, Wisconsin, New Jersey, Virginia, the Blue Ridge Mountain area, back down at the Bluebird, and then August, Ohio, in August, Ohio, Maine, Connecticut, Quebec. And then your standing gig is at the Bluebird with Mike Henderson. And those are generally, what, Monday nights throughout the
every
year?
Monday.
Every Monday.
Every Monday.
That's
we're there every day. Occasionally they'll get a private party in there or something, or Mike will not be able to do it on a Monday. But by and large, we're there every Monday night. After the there's a open mic night. It's also on Mondays. We're after that. So usually if you get down to the Bluebird around 9 o'clock, that's a good time. There's usually a line out the door. So you kind of want to get there early so you can get in. Because it's a small place.
Yes, it is. And probably made more famous now since the TV show Nashville. What impact has that had on the music scene and on the Bluebird? Have you seen bigger crowds or more interest?
It's been unbelievable. That show came on, our crowds at the Bluebird doubled instantly, and even more than that now. Now it's sold out every Monday, And it, I believe,
wow,
it's directly from that show. That show, trickle-down effect to for all the music that's going on in Nashville. And I actually, they actually hired me to, I was on an episode. And
which
and
one?
I played the part of a piano player. Imagine that. I was on the Opry and it was backing up. Her name is Claire, but I can't remember her character's name. The blonde, Claire Bowen is her name.
Juliet. Juliet's the character.
Not Juliet. The other blonde.
Oh, okay. I know who you mean. I can see her in my mind. It begins with an S. Scarlett.
Scarlett.
Right.
So I backed up Scarlett on the Opry. So whenever she went on her first Opry thing, I was her piano player on that. And I also have performed with her and other Chip and other people from the cast. I played at their rap party, and I played on the View with them up in New York, and a couple other things. So,
the date that you were on The View, do you? I'd love to share that with my followers.
The date, I don't remember the date.
I'll have to look that up. How exciting, you were on The View with them. So what was that like?
Yeah. It was an early morning. I've done a fair amount of those TV shows up there. With Delbert, we used to go on the Don Imus show quite a bit. And it's the thing I always say that's weird about doing that stuff is that, you know, they wake you up at 4 a.m. and get you to the studio by 5 a.m. And you're making music at 6:30 a.m., which is just seems really unnatural.
I was just going to say, you haven't even maybe gone to bed the night before. Yeah, that seems really unnatural to kind of rev up and get into the kind of the energy intensity that you perform with. You're just, it's like running a marathon at some early crazy hour. Now, was Whoopi on the show at that time? Coffee Help.
I'm sorry, say it again.
Was Whoopi Goldberg one of the hosts that day? Was that your first time meeting her?
No, I'd actually been on The View before years ago. I don't even remember when. I went on with Dina Carter, country singer. With her and her father was the great Fred Carter, who was a fantastic session musician in Nashville. So that was, it was really cool to get to go do that with him. But that was, I don't know, that was 15 years ago, maybe.
Oh, my goodness. So so you have been involved with the Nashville show, and that's been a very successful show. I mean, we've watched it, and we've got a lot of friends that have watched it. I think it has brought a lot of attention to the city. And, I mean, it's a beautiful city. It's a very reasonable car. I mean,
it's a great place. It's really it's grown a lot since I've been there. But one thing I like about that show is it really shows the good, you know, the good side of that city. It's kind of made Nashville cool in a way, you know. And I think the perception of Nashville before that, especially, you know, maybe 20 years ago, was that it was not cool. And it's turned into this kind of real hip place to be. Lots of young people are moving there. There's all kinds of stuff going on. And, of course, God, the music industry, you know, I mean, it's all there. And people from L.A. and New York are, you know, have been flocking in for years now. And there's more records made in Nashville of any kind than anywhere else on the planet.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yep.
And we were there this past July 4th. It seems to be coming our annual tradition is to go down for the July 4th holiday. And, of course, it rained like cats and dogs, but we were on top of the Adventure Center watching from the roof. But we got over to the Two Old Hippies store. Mm-hmm. Have you performed there? And, you know, what's the history of that location?
Well, I don't know a whole lot about that location except for about the Two Old Hippies. I've played there a couple times with some people, and I had a friend who worked there who booked it for a little while. I know that their original store is in Aspen. And so they've got the Two Old Hippies in Aspen and Two Old Hippies in Nashville.
Oh,
that's
hilarious.
About as much as I know about it.
Well, it does seem that Nashville is a hip, cool place, because I know the 80s, I was there for the first time, and, you know, I was a snobby Yankee. I'll have to admit, I came from New England, and I thought, oh, Nashville, you know, I felt like I was going down to the deep south or something, and I got
right.
there, and it was beautiful. The cherry blossoms were blooming, and went to Belle Meade, and, you know, there's just a lot to do there, I think, more than people might realize. And,
yes.
You know, and now it's the Frist Museum. You have museums. You have, you know, outdoor
yep.
beautiful botanical parks, and then all the Civil War history around Franklin
yep.
and that area, and
yep.
the Hermitage, Andrew Jackson's home. So it's a great place. So, what are some of the lessons that you've learned along the way that can help other entrepreneurs, other musicians, anyone pursuing a big dream?
Well, you know, it's funny to, you know, have that perspective on it. I feel like I'm still in it. I'm still, you know, I mean, there is, I guess the biggest thing is that there is no destination. I mean, if you've reached your destination, you're
6 feet under,
what?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, exactly. So, you know, there is a goal.
There is no destination.
But reaching it isn't it, you know. I don't know how to really say that. But,
yeah.
The only way to, I don't know, I feel like any success I've had has been incremental and small, and I don't realize any of it until I take a good look back and say, wow, I am doing those things that I wanted to do. I remember it was about that same time when I was struggling to make a living, and I had that piano shop job, and I just remember telling Laura, my wife, that I know I can do this. I know I'm capable. I can make a living making records. I just don't know how to get in there, but someday that's what I want to do. And it didn't happen overnight, but it did happen, and it's happening now, and it's, you know, more and more exciting things still seem to come up. And as my friend Steve Mackey always has a saying that I like, you know, you keep widening your circle, and you keep adding people to your circle of who you know and work with and want to be around. And as you do that, you get more and more opportunities. It's exponential when you do that.
Excellent. I love that. That's actually what I talk about a lot as well, is, you know, to build your relationships and keep them authentic, be around like-minded people. The right people are going to show up in your life that are going to self-identify as your best business partners and co-creators in your dreams. So if you were speaking to a class of young people that want to have their own business someday, what would you say the most important thing is in running your own business?
For me, and I don't know, for me, it is, it goes back to that mission statement. It's an important thing, I think, when you have a business and it's yours, you know, you really need to figure out what it is you're doing and why you're doing it, and be specific, and why, you know, and you need to stick with that. Like, you know, because, hey, if I'm not making good music with my friends, well, I'm off my path. I'm off my mark. And if I know that if I stay on my mark and I'm honest to and true to who I am and what I do, that will be reflected in the job that I do and the people that, you know, want to come work with me, because they, you know, there's integrity. And I would just say, you know, be honest, be true to who you are.
I love it. Be honest, be true, be who you are. And for listeners who want to get one of your CDs, Hammers and Strings is available on Kevin's website, Kevin McKendree, and it's spelled McKendree.com. And that CD has been very well received. I love the version of Lionel Hampton's Boogie Woogie that you renamed Boogie 427 that we played at the beginning of the program. We're going to play that at the end as well. But also there's so many great songs on there. Let's Go Get Stoned, Just Before Sunrise, Fool's Paradise, etc. How has that, CD been, going? How have you been promoting it?
Well, I put it, that CD came out, I don't know, it's been 6 or 7 years now, I think. I made that CD, it was one of the first things I did after I built the studio. And I had made one CD before that, and I played a lot of guitar on it. I'm also a guitar player. Most people know me for the piano, though, so people would buy that record and go, hey, it was great guitar, but we want piano records. So I made the next record, Hammers and Strings, with only one rule, which was no guitar. So there's not a guitar anywhere on that record. Most of it's just piano trio stuff, and though I've added some B3 and some percussion and stuff, but there's no guitar on it. I think it's an interesting thing for blues, these days. It's so guitar driven that people forget that, blues music really kind of started out on piano.
Wow, yeah. With roots in the South, right? The blues pretty much started.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, all of, American music really, it all came from the South. In fact, Al Anderson's got a song called that. It Came from the South.
It Came from the South. Do you have any other plans for future CDs?
I always, my line to Laura is always, in my spare time. I would love to make another CD. The problem with that is no one's paying me to do it. I have other people who are paying me to make their CDs, so making my CD has to be put on the back burner when I have time to do it. But yes, I would love to.
Oh, yeah, we need more CDs there, Kevin. So how has technology impacted your music and music business, positively and negatively? How is technology?
On the positive side, recording gear that used to cost $1 million now only costs $100,000. How about that? And it's just a person can go buy good recording gear now without mortgaging their house to do it. So that's the positive side of it, I would say. The negative side is that digital information is easily stolen and downloaded. There's also the Pandoras and Spotify, where the royalties that they're paying the artists, you can have millions of airplay and you make 16 cents. So as far as the technology goes affecting artists in that way, I mean, it's really not good. People are stealing music and thinking that that's okay. Not really sure how they justify that, but I'm not sure what's going to happen, because the thing is it's expensive to make a record. A small budget for a CD is around $15,000. So if you spend the very bare minimum, $15,000, and make a CD, and then people steal it from you, or steal your MP3s from you, how are you gonna make that $15,000 back? And the major labels are spending probably $100,000, $200,000 per recording. I don't know how they're doing it when everyone,
what has been your decision not to go with a major label?
Well, I've never been approached by a major label, so I...
we'll have to work on that one, won't we?
I'm not interested in being signed to any label. And here is... I can release my own. You know, the burden of promotion is on me in this way, and that's probably the hardest part, but... I can press my own CDs. I can get my own music put on iTunes. I can get my own. I can sell them from my website. I can sell them at my shows. And if I'm the record company, I make all of the money. So
right.
if I spend $15,000 to make a CD, and I sell them for $15, I only need to sell 1,000 of them to break even. If I were on a label. The way the labels work is they basically loan you the money to make your CD. You pay it back out of your small royalty. So let's say the labels said, okay, $150,000, but you owe us $150,000, and we're going to take it out of your 8% that you get on it. Well, you're never, ever, ever going to pay it back. You're always going to be in debt to that record company unless you sell, 2 million records. And even then, your royalty on it is, not even 10% of what the label's making from it.
Hmm.
So it's
not a good deal. Better to be independent.
It's not.
Yeah,
it's better to be, especially in this day and age.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have to do all the work. If you want to sell a CD, you've got to promote it. You've got to buy the ads. You've got to go out there and play the shows. You've got to meet your fans. You've got to, there's a lot to do.
Right.
But in the long run, if you sell 10,000 CDs on your own, well, you've made a nice chunk of change. And however, if you go on a major label and you sell 10,000, they're going to drop you. In a second, you won't have made a dime. You'll still owe them $150,000.
Wow, and it's like that with book publishing too. Well, we want to ask you to set up the last closing song. Actually, I decided I think we're going to play Henry's Dead close out the program. Tell us a little bit about that song, what it's about, what inspired you to do that one.
Well, I've always been one of the first things I ever learned, in fact, it was the first thing I ever learned how to play on the piano was the Baby Elephant Walk, which is a Henry Mancini song. My grandfather taught me that. And he also, it was my third or fourth birthday, bought me a Henry Mancini album. And it had I just loved all of Henry Mancini's stuff, Peter Gunn, and with just tons of really great instrumental music. So it's kind of inspired by him. I always liked his kind of spooky chord changes, and I thought I'd take a boogie, and most boogies are in major key, and I thought I'd put it in a minor key and see how it worked. And it just was kind of inspired by Henry Mancini in a way, at least the chord structure of it. I mean, he didn't do any boogies, but anyway, that's kind of the story behind that.
Excellent. Well, we have 90 seconds left, so we're going to go out with Kevin McKendry on piano for Henry's Dead. And check Kevin out at the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville on Monday nights, playing with Mike Henderson. And please visit his website and find him on Facebook. Thank you so much, Kevin. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Brenda. Okay. Bye-bye.